You're listening to a journalism.co.uk podcast with me, Alistair Reid. Just as social media has become ubiquitous in all other forms of digital life, for journalism it is almost impossible to escape. Online, it has become the number one driver of traffic to many news organisation websites and a vital source of information. But with that come some inherent dangers. When anyone can publish anything and have it read globally in an instant, it might now be said that a lie can travel around the world before the truth has groggily hit the snooze button and hid back under the covers. The Columbia Journalism School's Tau Centre recently published a report titled Lies, Damn Lies and Viral Content, written by Craig Silverman. And in it, Craig argues that journalists and news organisations aren't doing enough to stop the spread of rumours and false information, and in some cases are actively helping lies to spread. There are a number of sources for such false information, Craig told me, from the malicious or mischievous to the mundane and mistaken, and a few different types of actors involved. At one end of the spectrum are governments and companies, purposefully trying to derail the agenda and divert attention away from reality for whatever political or commercial reasons they pursue. Some groups end up creating their own network of tweeters or other nodes of influence on social media to help spread the information, he said, and something that journalists need to be particularly aware of when seeking the truth. Islamic State, for one, has been terrifyingly effective in spreading its brutal message in this way, he said.
There's also fake news websites, which look like real news websites, publish articles that seem like the real thing, but they're completely fake. And some of their stuff is, you know, silly kind of celebrity death hoaxes, but some of it is actually them trying to jump on actual news events and find a fake angle on it that will get them shares, which generates traffic, which they then monetize with, you know, basic display ads. So there are those kind of entities out there. There are also, you know, there are even fake scientific journals that are publishing papers that have no scrutiny. And of course, then there are, you know, the average people who are kind of creating hoaxes here and there just as fun and as entertainment, and doing it not with any malicious intent most of the time, but just to entertain themselves and friends. And then I think, you know, one of the bigger categories, of course, are people who find stuff and see stuff and you know, misinterpret it and reshare it in an incorrect way, who see something and just pass along instantly, the kind of unintentional propagators of misinformation.
When it comes to breaking news, rumours are very important in a kind of shared sense-making, he said, particularly around a big event. So in recent years, the Boston bombing or Hurricane Sandy and the Charlie Hebdo attacks have all spawned rumours in the initial hours as people make false connections or pass on unverified or false claims in an attempt to make sense of what is happening. If this chimes with what people want to believe or already believe, then misinformation can spread like wildfire on social media.
And what that just means is there's like these roving packs of journalists just kind of hunting Reddit and other places, looking for anything that might get traffic, throwing it up as quickly as they can, and then moving on. And there's a much smaller group of people who are actually looking at this stuff, kind of poking and prodding it and trying to verify it to figure out whether it's true or not. And so the dynamic is there's, you know, the places that are just kind of propagating without necessarily verifying or analyzing it. They're big sites, they get a lot of traffic, and they can have a big impact. And so it seems like for the people who want to verify it, it just seems like, well, what's the point? You know, why should I take the time and do this when everyone else is just going to jump on it? So I think there's definitely a mindset and a strategy change that needs to take place.
One example that stood out to me recently was a story coming out of Iraq at the end of January that ISIS militants had murdered 13 teenage football fans in Mosul for watching the Iraq versus Jordan football match. Now, it first came to my attention on Facebook as a link shared by a friend with comments of shock and disgust, with a photo of a grieving mother cradling her bloodied son as the headline image. The story seemed almost too extreme, even for ISIS, so I ran the picture through image verification tool TinEye and found out it was actually a photo taken in Gaza last summer. The website that story was posted to referenced a UK newspaper as the source, so I traced the story back a step and found a number of UK national newspaper websites had run stories around the 19th and 20th of January referencing a website called Raqqa is being slaughtered silently as their source. So I traced the story again. Raqqa is a Syrian city that has become the de facto capital for the Islamic State and their barbaric practices, and Raqqa is being slaughtered silently is an activist site based out of Turkey, according to a Wall Street Journal interview with the founder. There was no story of ISIS executing 13 teenage boys in Mosul anywhere on the Raqqa is being slaughtered silently website, and at the time of recording this podcast, the website is down. Authors at the site itself, though, told me they only ever published the story in Arabic and sent me the original copy. After translating with Google, the story attributes the quote, press sources in Mosul, unquote, as where the story actually came from. Now, there's no record of international news agencies reporting the crime, and the New York Times recently reported that the UN could not confirm whether this had actually taken place. At the UK news organisations, one journalist said they were given the story by their editor and trusted the source, while at another outlet, I was told the story was, quote, provided by a reliable freelancer who monitors these sites on a regular basis, unquote. Now, I'm not in a position to say whether or not this actually happened, but all over the world, thousands of websites are proclaiming that militants murdered 13 teenage boys for watching a football match, referring to one of the UK outlets as their source. After a little digging, it is very hard to verify the story. Craig's report is full of examples like this, taken from his work in identifying and verifying rumours that started on social media. Remember the story last year that a mass grave in Mexico held the bodies of missing students? It was false. 13 news outlets published a story on the rumour, but only 5 published a follow-up. In 2015, there are more tools and more ways to verify information online than there have ever been before. And the verification handbook, for one, should be known to anyone who publishes news online. But why are some journalists or news organisations not following through with this verification process as they would do, say, before the internet? Margarita Noriega, who was editor in charge of live news at Reuters in New York before becoming director of social media at Fusion, says it's largely about journalists being caught out and not knowing how to properly verify information on social media.
People who do understand it rarely neglect to check sources appropriately using social media. It's only when you have someone who doesn't understand the difference between a verified account and an unverified account, for example, on Twitter, that you find, you know, a story about, this celebrity tweeted something goofy today, and, well, guess what, it's a parody account, and if you knew a little bit about the platform, you would know that, but it's pure ignorance, really.
Besides, it's only a small number of journalists who do this, she said, and the repercussions can be damning.
It's really no more than 5% of people who are in a rush to get things up. Those people are known, I think, in the community. Those editors are known by social media editors not to be trusted. And you can certainly get a very quick reputation as a journalist these days by posting incorrect viral content to your personal page. It's something that affects media company reputation as well as individual journalists.
Craig takes a slightly more cynical viewpoint, though.
We're seeing a lot of news organizations and news websites not necessarily looking at information saying, okay, let's figure out what's real here. Instead, they're kind of grabbing it and saying, well, this might get some traffic and attention. Let's put it up quickly, and then we'll sort of see what happens over time. And I think there are a variety of factors driving that. One of them is just that the information environment is very different. We have stuff that is by default kind of public and out there more than ever before, and there's a huge amount of that stuff. So journalists might have been used to having stuff come to them from sources or get into a newsroom from phone calls or other things, and they could sort of look at that information and work on it, and it wasn't really out there yet, and they would take their time with it, whereas today it's already out there. Maybe it's on a social network, it's circulating in some way. And so for newsrooms, they're sort of saying, well, if it's already public, then we should just sort of point to it, and we should say that this is out there. And maybe use some hedging of language around it to say, hey, it's a photo, it's circulating, maybe it's on Reddit. We don't know if it's true, but wow, imagine if it is.
With the way online publishing works these days, there is an editorial and a commercial need to ride the wave of a popular story. Right now, as I speak, Twitter is losing its mind over a photo of a blue and black dress that sometimes appears as white and gold to the viewer because of the way our brains process light. A story on BuzzFeed about it has been up for around 12 hours but had more than 22 million views. Yes, 22 million and growing. So the whole of the mainstream internet is running think pieces, explainers and follow-ups to get in on some of that traffic. That's just how the internet works at the moment. And although she wasn't talking about this example, Margarita voiced her frustration about this trend.
The thing that I find frustrating is that there's the myth that because something happens on social media, it is of interest to people who are on that platform. That, to me, is such a logical fallacy. And I don't know, you know, there's this weird assumption that if something is popular on Instagram, that it must be newsworthy. And that's not. That's absurd. I find it silly that people are writing stories based off of something that appears to be popular within that network.
Chasing social media trends can lead to getting caught out, though, as Craig mentioned earlier. And when a host of media sites ended up running a story on a new pumpkin spice flavored condom last year, that was just another internet fake.
Right. It's like someone's clearly playing a joke on the fact that the media, you know, there's some media schlub out there who's going to write a story about that as if it were real just because people find it funny. And you begin to see a counter anti-media reaction that specifically tries to trick the media. And so my only other tip would be, you know, don't take yourself and what you do so seriously, because there are people who want to, you know, perhaps sabotage you for maybe taking yourself too seriously. And then second, you know, if something is popular, that is not an indication of news value. You have to know what your newsroom considers news value before you jump into social media.
For a frivolous end of week story like the blue and black dress, traffic chasing is a harmless, if infuriating, phenomenon. When it's an unverified prank, like the pumpkin spice condom, it can be embarrassing. But when it comes to atrocities, like alleging that militants executed 13 teenage boys for watching a football match, it is much more serious. It can affect decisions for military action. It can be the difference between more people living or dying. The opportunity for traffic and attention is greatest in the early moments of a story, said Craig, when it's something that's new, when it's a scoop. And that's a strong factor that can influence people's decision to share it online when they don't know if it's true or not. For news organisations, another motivating factor aside from traffic is competition, he said. That, quote, everyone else is doing it, so we need to, or we'll look like we're behind and we'll lose audience, unquote.
The vast majority of time, news articles about a rumour or an unverified claim were just linking to other news articles about it. So nobody was actually finding the original source. Nobody was actually tracking it back. Once you had one news organization that jumped on it, everybody else just said, oh, they jumped, so we'll point to them, and now the responsibility is on them. Somebody called it third-party verification, where basically it's someone else's job. So you have folks who are just, you know, as long as somebody else has put it up there, they'll just link to them and sort of, you know, wash their hands of it and walk away. And all of those things lead to the spreading of misinformation and just, you know, presenting information that may be true or may be false in a way that leads people to think it's probably more credible.
So at the moment, says Craig, there are the mindless propagators who write up anything and everything, and there are those who stay quiet and just don't touch the rumours. What that leaves, he says, is a middle ground where news outlets can still be involved in the story, but keep their credibility by exploring ways to debunk the rumours.
You know, right now it's very clear what the upside is of just throwing anything up you can find. There are plenty of websites, very large ones, that are doing that are reaping traffic from that. And so for me, I don't think a lot of them are going to change their behavior, because as long as they're getting traffic for that, they're going to continue to do it. For me, what it says is, you know, what do other people do? And so in that respect, you know, if everybody knows that that's what you get if you do that, we haven't yet found out what you get if you take an alternate approach. We haven't yet found out what happens if you start A/B testing debunking headlines. We haven't yet found out what happens if you think about different story forms of telling information, conveying information that is debunking something or giving clarity to something. So all the testing and all the effort has been done in the pure propagation piece. And if people actually invested some of the, you know, analytics and audience development and analysis that they had put into all of that stuff into figuring out, well, what's a valid counter strategy, I think that we would start to see some of that upside come out there.
This is early days, though. Craig pointed out that Gawker had long jumped on trending stories to gain traffic, but the new mandate from the editor-in-chief is to, quote, be people's trusted guide, which ultimately should be the bottom line for journalists anyway. Elsewhere, Snopes.com has long succeeded in debunking myths. Caitlin Dewey runs the What Was Fake on the Internet This Week column for the Washington Post, and Daily Mirror spin-off Us Versus Them has a history of taking apart online rumours with trademark acerbic wit. This could go on to include fact-checking sites like Full Fact or PolitiFact, but it remains that much of the mainstream media has yet to take up the mantle of debunking. In terms of advice, there are more don'ts than do's at the moment, though, said Craig.
And there's frankly a lot more to point out that's really wrong about and bad about what people are doing than good practices at this point. And so one of the things that we saw, and I was actually surprised to the extent that this was present in the articles that we were tracking and the rumors we were tracking, is that we saw news sites taking something that was unverified, and they would write a headline that would declare it as true, that had no hedging language, you know, nothing to indicate, well, you know, it may be true, maybe not. And so they would declare it to be true in the headline, and then they would take the body text, and then they would put in some of that attribution stuff according to or reports say or claimed and that kind of language. And when you look at the research that's been done around headlines, the first thing that's very clear about news headlines is that they are tremendously powerful. They frame everything about how that particular person is going to understand the subsequent information. So if you say something in the headline and then you try to mitigate that by the body text, you're probably not going to be effective at all if people are going to understand and remember the headline.
The recommendations based on research so far go on. So to debunk the idea and not the person, to maybe appeal to emotions or biases and get the same amount of social traction as the rumor that maybe a cold, hard debunk might not, or thinking hard about how it is presented online. There is, however, real value in sharing unverified content on social media first, says Margarita, if done so in a way that is very, very clear that it is unverified and with a purpose in mind other than just propagation.
There was a Vine a couple of years ago that showed a shooting at a celebration in New Orleans. And, you know, later it was confirmed that the Vine actually did show what it appeared to show. But when people first discovered this Vine, first of all, it was the only video of that shooting that was accessible to the media, or the first video anyway. Second, the video was pretty clear. And third, you know, there was a clear source. There was someone who posted it on a personal social media account that had a full name, right? A contactable person. It wasn't, you know, an anonymous Twitter account or an anonymous Vine account. And I think it was super important for people to share that Vine because it needed the power of the media to build a verification around it. So, for example, when I share unverified content, what I like to do, and I see Moses Brown doing this a lot, he pings things, right? He pings his community. So he says, hey, have you guys seen this? What do you guys think about it? And all of a sudden, instead of you just working to verify that piece of content, you have 100 journalists who are working to verify that piece of content. So there is strategic value to the newsroom in sharing unverified content because it means that your competitors become your allies in verifying the content itself.
Verifying sources and information should be the basic expectation on a news desk, and the level to which rumors are creeping into news is dangerous. But there is time to turn the tide.
I think you can still be fast. I think you can still capture traffic. But if you take a little bit of time and say, well, I'm not just going to write the quick hit post, I'm going to, you know, set a clock literally for 10 minutes and see what I can find, oftentimes you're going to get some value out of that. And then you have something other people don't have. And so I think that that's just a very clear thing people could be doing in a tangible way that isn't going to hurt them on the time and the frequency and all those pieces that are really big motivators and pressures in newsrooms. We're not supposed to be in the business of just throwing stuff out there that we don't know whether it's true or not and misleading people and then not actually following up when we find out whether it's true or not. You know, we're not supposed to be in the business of actually propagating misinformation. And so if in your newsroom that's not really a concern, then there's probably no argument I can make. If it is a concern in your newsroom, and if you do want to actually play, you know, a more positive role, a basic journalistic role, then I think, you know, we're duty bound to figure out what are the really effective strategies on this. And that's the bottom line of all this research is, you know, it's very clear what the upside is from the bad behavior. But people haven't just haven't invested the resources and the time into figuring out how do we actually make the good stuff go viral? What does a viral debunking actually look like? We don't know the answer to that question because nobody's really trying.
The report, Lies, Damn Lies and Viral Content, is free to download and published by the Tau Centre, as is the Verification Handbook, published by the European Journalism Centre. And as Craig said, journalists shouldn't be in the business of chasing traffic, but uncovering the truth. But if we can find a way to combine the two, what possible downside is there? You've been listening to a Journalism.co.uk podcast.